still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite.
Hello, hello, hello. It is Textbook on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. Today, we're doing normal textbook stuff. We're doing textbook, not so textbook. Textbook, not so textbook. It is, of course, Halloween weekend, and that is exciting. Lots to talk about. I'm going to start off with a song. They're having a new album that's coming up. I guess it's a bit spooky. It's a bit Halloween-y. It's also one of my favorite Vancouver bands, and they are playing a show on November 10th at the Emerald. This is Failing. They are a Vancouver band, very sludgy. Trying to cue up this song right here. Also on the show today, we have some folks talking about theater production. We have Amna El Noor talking about fairy tales. We have Elizabeth Holliday talking for the Tell Me About Your Paper segment. Here first, though, is The Apple in the Pig's Mouth by Failing. CITR 101.9 FM, this is Textbook. Hello, Textbook. This is Josh. You just heard Greatest Gift of Them All from Failing, their Apple in the Pig's Mouth album. They are coming up with a new one very, very soon. definitely one to look forward to. Next, you're going to hear an interview with Elena Mabrito, who is putting on production here at UBC. This is an interview you recorded a little earlier today, pre-recorded. So yeah, enjoy.
On campus, and the project is not through the UBC Players Club, but I'm doing it with a woman who's also involved with the club. Her name's Annie Ramsey. She's in the theater BFA. And back in, I guess, like April of last year, she was kind of playing around with the idea of doing the show. She read it in one of her classes and fallen in love with it. And she was kind of thinking about doing it. And I was like, can I direct? And so it started out as just kind of this kind of idea in the back of our minds, and we started in May doing table work, and then in June we started blocking, and it was very, very daunting at first. We just kind of, we were both, you know, working full-time this summer and kind of squeezed in rehearsals after work in her basement and on my back porch and in the park near my house, so it was very kind of ad hoc for the first couple months. So it's a piece about bullying amongst young women and how really relational violence among girls and young women is often not as recognized as physical aggression among boys and young men. It's based off the real life story of Rena Virk, who was murdered on Vancouver Island in 1997 by a group of her peers, by a group of 14-year-old girls. And both Annie and I are really passionate about using theater as a way to facilitate social change. So that's kind of how this process started, was we're both really passionate about that and both wanted to do that like with our lives, and this was kind of a cool project for us to do, like a piece that's about social issues and which we could lead our own process.
And the play itself is called The Shape of a Girl.
The Shape of a Girl, yeah, right. By Joan McLeod.
Right, and so tell me a little bit more about the play. Is it a one act play?
It is. It's a one woman, one act play. So it's 80 minutes long. So it requires a lot of stamina. Annie does an amazing job with it. So it's about this 15-year-old woman named Brady. And Brady is 15 years old at the time that Rena Virk was murdered. Now, that's a true story. She was actually killed on Vancouver Island by her peers in 1997. And so Brady is 15 years old when this happens. And she finds herself just fascinated by the murder and by the murders, because they're all over the news. She sees them everywhere. And she's fascinated by this, and she doesn't quite know why. And through flashbacks, so we see her when she's 8, when she's 10, when she's 12, when she's 14, and then present day when she's 15, we figure out, and as we figure out, Brady figures out that she's so interested in this murder case because her friend group dynamics mirror that of Rena's friend group, and she realizes that for the past 7 years, she's been in a friend group where there's some really, really serious bullying going on. And at the end of the piece, it's really cool. Brady actually steps forward and tells an adult about what's been happening. And so the story doesn't end like Rena's story. The girl who's been the victim is okay. And something I really like about the piece, like, it's not preachy. Like, I think it could have very easily been quite preachy. But it's also not sugar-coated, which is nice. Like, Joan McLeod, she makes it clear that for these women in this story, in this fictional story, like, they will bear these scars, both physical and emotional, like, for the rest of their lives. There's no doubt about that. Like, their stories have been written. They will be okay, but they will bear these scars. But what I really love about the piece is just how she says it's not inevitable. Like, this violence, this bullying isn't inevitable. Like, we can change it. And I think it's a really powerful message. I think it's a really hopeful message.
It's really difficult to kind of get those social issues on the stage and to represent them well. And I think it's even more difficult doing it sort of as an independent production, as you guys have. What kind of challenges did you guys come up against in putting together the play?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it was tough not having like a structure or a framework. Like, I've never done, so I act and direct, but I've never done a production where it was just kind of like, self-led. Like, we set our own rehearsal schedule. We led our own process. We started rehearsing when we started rehearsing, just kind of like in our houses and, you know, rooms where we could find them. So that was definitely a challenge, I'd say, just kind of, when we started, we had this 80-minute piece, this 80-minute one-woman piece, and just kind of this, it was like this immense mountain in front of us. It was this immense hurdle, and there were definitely times where I was like, you know what, we're not gonna do this. Like, it's just too much. Like, it's too much between working, and it's such an intense piece. Like, it was so emotional. So I think, yeah, that was probably the biggest challenge, seeing if we could actually do it. But that was also cool. Like, when we started the process, we made a list of, like, kind of a mission statement, I guess. And one of our goals for the process was we both wanted the ability to lead our own process, because when you do theater, usually you're, it's within a framework, like you're working with a production company or whatever. And we really wanted this process to focus on us and to be the process we wanted. And we wanted to allow ourselves during this process time to get to know each other, because we think that's a really, really important part of the rehearsal process that's sometimes not focused on, is just the interpersonal connection between the cast and the director.
And as a director, what did your process look like? What kind of decisions were you making?
Yeah, so we started by just reading the text and then kind of working our way through it, just talking about it, talking about themes. So we did a couple of rehearsals of just, table work, where you just sit down and you talk about the text. Then we got into blocking. One of the challenges of this play was it's a one-woman show, but there's a lot of characters in it. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the challenges for us, was trying to figure out how to clearly represent who is speaking in each scene when we just have one person to do it. And there's like, it's a really quick switch back and forth between the people who are speaking. So it was a bit of a challenge. I'd say, like, for me, my rehearsal process is really collaborative. I really, I view directing as creating a space in which the actor can make art. And I think that's a really amazing responsibility and a really, really amazing privilege to create a space in which people feel comfortable being vulnerable and, you know, taking risks and making mistakes and making autonomous choices. I really put a lot of weight on my actor, on Annie in this case, like on her preferences and needs, because I'm a big believer, like, if she's uncomfortable on stage, if she doesn't agree with the decision that's being made with a piece of blocking, it's not going to look right to the audience. I view it as a very holistic process. Like, it's about telling the story, but it's also very much about personal development. It's about getting to know each other. It's about getting to know yourself better. It's about connecting what's happening, the text, and seeing how it resonates with what's happened in your own life.
What's your background in theater like? How did you get into it?
Yeah, I started acting when I was younger. I just did like community theater. Actually, my first role was as one of the dwarves in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I was 8 years old, so kind of typecasting. I acted kind of all through in my younger years. And then I got into directing in high school, and I just like fell in love with it immediately. Like, I don't think there's really anything I've ever fallen in love with quite so quickly. Like I said, like, I love the ability to create a space in which people do really, really vulnerable work. Like, I just think it's such a beautiful privilege. And just to like create art. And like I said, I'm really passionate about using art as a medium to talk about social justice issues. And I think it's a really effective medium to talk about social justice issues. So just kind of got into it in high school and kept going with it through college, got involved with the UBC Players. And this is actually my first full length production I'm directing by myself. I've directed for one act festivals in the States and Canada, and have AD'd, assistant directed for a full length piece as kind of a grade 12 final project in high school. But this is my first time steering the ship by myself. So that's exciting.
What are you studying?
International relations and creative writing.
Do you find that, I mean, I assume the creative writing kind of slips in there,
yeah,
but do you find that what you've been studying at UBC has kind of influenced the decisions you make and kind of that interest in social issues?
Absolutely. I decided not to do, kind of like coming into university, I decided that I didn't want to do theater. I decided on international relations because I want to have, like I said, I want to be able to use theater to talk about politics, history, gender, race, and social justice. And with international relations, it's so interdisciplinary and it touches on all of those things. And though when I graduate, I'll have a good grounding. I'll have a good background. So I'll be able to talk about those topics intelligently. I'll be able to talk about those topics with a good understanding. And I'll be able to communicate them through this thing that I'm so passionate about, through theater. I took a gender, race, and social justice class first year, and just really found my niche. But I like the more interdisciplinary approach of IR.
Right. So, yeah. Right. Tell me a little bit about how this play developed visually. I can imagine that there's a lot of challenges there.
Yeah, so it was interesting. So when we first started this process, Annie and I were like, oh, you know what we really want to do? And I'm laughing because it's just like so much. We're like, you know, we want to take this play out into the community and like share it with youth. And we want to like, you know, so our preview, which is on Thursday, we were like, you know, we're going to invite educators and we're going to invite artistic directors who are interested in working with emerging artists. And, you know, and this is going to be kind of like our starting jumping off point. And then we'll take it out into the community and use it as an educational initiative. And so with that in mind, visually, the piece is very, very simple because the idea was to take it out into any school, any cafeteria, any library, any whatever, and be able to do the show. So there's no technical elements. The set is three chairs, and they're just normal chairs you could find anywhere. It's very, very simple. And now we're just doing the one performance. Like, we've decided that it's a very intense emotional piece, and we've decided we're both a little bit, like, it's been a lovely process, but we're both done. This is a good stopping point. It's very simple, but it's been interesting because, yeah, like, we started, the first 2 months of the rehearsal process were kind of just in, like ad lib spaces, like I said, like her basement, my back porch. And so we didn't have a ton of room. And then we got to UBC in the fall and started rehearsing, you know, in the Nest and in other spaces on campus. And it was nice to finally have a lot of room to move. So it's very simple. There are a couple props, but there's a lot of the chairs are used as many different elements. That's something I like to do, is to have pieces that are used as many different things. I think of it kind of as like choreography. Like, it's called blocking. That's what it's called when people move on stage. But I think of it more as choreography because there should be kind of a fluidity to a piece, a certain flow. Because from beginning to end, it's one chunk, it's one snapshot.
Was there any kind of play or director that you were looking to as a model while you're doing this?
That's a good question. I don't think so. When I was, like I said, when I was in high school, my final project for my final year of high school was I got to do this assistant directing project with one of the drama teachers at my high school. And I was really lucky. The high school I went to had this great drama program that was led by actors in Seattle. I'm from Seattle, in the Seattle area. And that was an amazing project. The teacher I worked with, his name was Albin, and we were putting in like 20, 25 hours a week on this piece about wage inequalities in the U.S. And that was an amazing experience, just to just learn about the directing process. And it was a huge cast. It was like 26 people. So just to learn about like people management too, and just to go through that whole process and have this really amazing final product at the end. So I've learned so much from him. And yeah, he's just super, super inspiring. So not someone famous, but a dear personal friend.
Tell me a little bit more about your relationship with the play itself and how it developed over the course.
Okay. So what's interesting about this piece, so when Annie and I first kind of sat down with it, so Annie fell in love with this piece immediately, and that's why she brought it up, as she wanted to do it. She just connected with it. She really connected with Brady, who's the main character, right away, the kind of Brady struggle. And the question kind of that is asked of the piece, and is asked as Brady goes through this journey, is there such a thing as an innocent bystander? Is that actually a thing? Or does everyone who, you know, sees something, does everyone have a responsibility to step in and voice their concerns? So that's kind of the question. And so Annie really identified with Brady and her struggle to you know, step up. And that's hard, right? Brady's, you know, she goes between 8 and 15. She's young. Like, that's a hard, even adults have trouble with that, right? It took me a little bit longer to get into the play. But at this point, like, I kind of, every show I do, I always, by the end of it, I find I've fallen in love with it. Like, I just think it's part of the rehearsal process. Like, by the end, I've fallen in love with the characters, I've fallen in love with the script. And I think for me, the thing that did it was kind of like what I was saying earlier about how just there's this hopefulness to the piece. There's for these women, their story is written, but that's not the case for all women. Like, if we start the conversation, if we break the cycle, the stories can be changed, the stories can be written in a different way. So I think that was the thing that really, like, resonated for me, that kind of, I guess, like, candle of hope in the dark, that it doesn't have to be this way, that violence is not inevitable.
Tell me a little bit more about the issues that come up in the play and how you've been able to sort of situate them when we're talking about violence between friend groups and within mm-hmm. social circles. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's like a bunch of different issues in the play. Kind of the main thing is, so there's in Brady's friend group, there's this one girl who is the perpetrator. Her name is Adrienne, and she's the one who starts it when they are 8 years old. Like, she's the one who's really taking it out on Sophie, the victim. And as they get older, Adrienne's actions become increasingly violent and more so physically violent. And so that's kind of the dynamic of the piece. And it's tough because Brady's best friends with Adrienne. And so one of the questions is, how do you, how do you stand up to a friend? How do you stand up to your best friend? That's such a tough thing to do. So that's kind of one of the issues in the play. The other thing that I think is really interesting that is touched upon is how bullying affects everyone in a friend group, not just the victim. So actually one of the crux of the piece is a line where Brady's on the bus with Adrienne, and Adrienne is just she's put Sophie's head in the toilet, like she's just treated her horribly, and Brady looks over at Adrienne, and Brady's really, she's feeling sick, like she's just watched this horrific act of violence, and she looks over at Adrienne and she says, you know, the friend that I loved is gone. All that's left is the shape of a girl. And just the realization that, you know, Adrienne hasn't come out unscathed either. Like, yeah, Sophie was the victim, and you know, the wounds, the scars she has are horrific. But, you know, bullying affects everyone. Like, it's good for no one. And I think that's something we're really trying to emphasize with the piece, is that, you know, this doesn't serve anyone. And a part of our process was really in a way identifying with Adrienne or humanizing Adrienne. And we talked about that a lot, kind of Adrienne's motivations, because I'm a big believer. I don't think most people do things because they're malevolent. I think most people do things because of the circumstances they're in. And so that was a huge, huge, huge focus of our process, was looking at Adrienne as a very human girl and a very human woman, and saying, why is she doing what she's doing? And so that was interesting too, to kind of humanize the perpetrator, not to excuse her behavior. But I think that's an important part of the healing process, is realizing that, the perpetrators are human too.
The rehearsal period sounds really intense. Were there certain moments or certain moments that you look back on and you think about how you kind of saw things come together and click?
So what was kind of interesting about this process, so for both Annie and I, this summer was very a very challenging summer for us both personally. And so we rehearsed June and July, and then Annie went home to Calgary for a month. And then I think when we came back, it was nice to have the break. It was good to have that break. I think getting into the UBC space was really helpful. Like I said, rehearsing on my back porch was not super conducive to the artistic process. It was pretty small. I think having blocked the piece was a huge step. Like, having gotten all the way through, having blocked it, you know, roughly completely, was really big. That was kind of the first time we went out for a celebratory tea after that, and it was kind of like the first time we were like, oh, like, this is happening, like we have this thing, like, it's rough and it's sloppy and it's messy, but it's like a thing, it's a fully formed thing. So that was super, super cool. I think that was really kind of once we started to be like, okay, like, we can do this, we have this full thing, we can refine it from here.
Helena, thank you so much for talking to me. The Shape of a Girl plays Thursday at Dorothy Somerset Theater on UBC campus. You should all check it out. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello, this is Josh, Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. It is Tuesday. It is around 4:25. That was an interview with Elena about a play that is coming up on Thursday, The Shape of a Girl. It is playing here on UBC campus. I urge you to go check it out. Next interview we have up here is with Amna El-Noor. Amna is a friend of mine, and she is going to speak about fairy tales. She's going to read a fairy tale. This is the second segment in the show. This is a storytelling segment. So get ready for that. This is a pre-recorded interview coming to you live, CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you so much for being with me. What's up?
Not much. I'm here to talk about fairy tales because it's Halloween.
It is Halloween. Amna, tell me a little bit about yourself. What are you studying? What are you doing here?
So I go to UBC. I'm a visual arts student. And I brought in some fairy tales to talk about because I'm very interested in horror and violence. I'm really interested in, like, exploring violent images and what they teach us about ourselves, I guess.
It's the best time of year for that.
Oh, yeah. I love Halloween. It's my favorite.
It's a really good holiday.
It's perfect. It's so secular and not secular at the same time.
That's true. I haven't actually thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a little pagan.
Oh, yeah.
It's got that pagan root.
Yeah, yeah. Coming out to appease the evil spirits by kind of dressing up as them.
Right.
Right. To protect that, yeah. yourself from them.
Why are you interested in fairy tales? Why are you attracted to them?
Okay, what attracts me about fairy tales is I'm really interested in, like, the narratives that we grow up with. I guess, like, some of the things I'm interested in and what I make are just feminism and the body and violence. Like, these things all have a weird connection for me. And, I mean, you grow up, the stories you grow up with do a lot to shape you. And looking back, like, I remember in high school going back and reading some of the Grimm fairy tales and realizing they're really messed up. Like, they, like, a lot of our, what we think of as happily ever after is just a prescription of, like, very rigid gender roles, and they're very violent, like, lots of violent murder.
Right.
And gruesome stuff happens in fairy tales. And I just thought it's interesting because we tell kids these stories and we don't think twice about it, but we like to criticize our cultures. Violence often,
right?
But
right.
these are still the stories you grew up with.
You kind of have this criticism of TV violence, movie violence,
video games.
Sure. Oh my god, video games are a big one. But then you have these kind of founding fairy tales, myths.
I can't think of any other stories that were so pivotal in my childhood.
Yeah, and just your idea of what it's going to be like to grow up.
Yeah,
too.
What it's going to be like to be in the world, how to behave.
But they're so violent; they're ridiculous.
Yeah, but that's how I mean if. Fairy tales, like we talk about, all these different aspects of our culture have a function. And so fairy tales, the purpose was kind of parents use them to teach their kids how to be without specifically telling them how to be. They use these stories to strike fear into their hearts and motivate them to be what they thought of as a good person, which I think is pretty messed up.
Yeah. What's the first fairy tale you have for us today?
So I have The Girl Without Hands.
Cool.
So I guess I'm just going to
go for it.
Tell it my way. So there's this miller, and he used to be rich, and then he ends up not being so rich anymore. He's losing his money, and this guy approaches him, this old man. He says, okay, I'll make you rich again. I just want what you have standing behind your house. I want what stands behind your house. And the miller, thinking it's the tree, says, sure, you can have that, whatever. But the old man is the devil, and the devil wants his daughter because she's standing outside sweeping, because that's what good girls do. So the man is really distraught because he's just unknowingly made a deal with the devil, and he goes to talk to his daughter, and she says, no, it's okay, I'm your daughter, I'll do whatever. So the day comes when the devil is supposed to take her away. She's been praying to God, been very pious. So she draws a circle of white chalk around her to protect her, and the devil can't take her because she's just so pure and good and stuff like that. And she's been weeping all over her hands because she doesn't want to go with the devil. So the devil says, you have to cut off this girl's hands because that's the deal. And the miller is like, what? Like, I can't cut off my kid's hands. That's just not, no, she's my kid. I love her. And the devil says, well, if you don't cut off her hands, I'm just going to take you. And the miller can't have that. So he goes and he approaches his daughter, and she says, it's okay, father, I'm your child. Like, it's whatever, just cut my hands off if you need to. So he cuts off the hands, and she continues to weep because that sucks. And she's weeping all over her stumps that she has instead of hands. And the devil still can't take her because she's so pure. So she just exiles herself into the forest or something. She ends up in a garden one day. She's eating pears off the trees with her mouth because this girl has no hands. And the priest and the king see her. She's in the royal garden. She doesn't know this. And they think, oh my gosh, it's a spirit. Like, what's going on? There's this spirit that appears and has eaten pears off the trees and has no hands. What is this? And the priest approaches her one day and he says, are you a spirit or a mortal? And she says, I'm an unhappy mortal that's been forsaken by all but God, of course. And then the king and the priest are like, okay, we'll take you in. So they take her in, and she's so good and so pious that the king just has to marry her, and he does, and she gets pregnant, and then he goes off to war, because that's what men do, and she has a child, a son, and so they're writing letters to him because he's got to know what's going on in the kingdom, and so they write to let him know that his son has been born, but the devil, who just hates this girl and has it out for her because she's so pure, switches the letters, and he makes the king think that she's given birth to a changeling, which is like a kind of monstrous baby that fairies have switched out for your child. But he's such a good guy that he's like, it's okay, just take care of them anyway. But the devil is interfering in their correspondence. And eventually the king's mom, elderly mother, gets a letter that she's supposed to murder the queen. And she's supposed to take her tongue and eyes as evidence that she has obeyed her son, who is the king. So she can't do it. She's like, oh, I can't murder these innocent spirits. So she has a hind killed. A hind is a deer. She has its eyes and tongue taken out as evidence, and she saves them. She tells the queen that she and her son have got to go. So she straps the baby to her back, and the queen goes off into the forest where she's found by an angel. The angel takes care of them in this house, watches over them. Once the king eventually returns and he sees what's been done, he weeps and weeps, and she's like, what? I thought you like wanted me to murder your wife and all that. So he realizes that she's not actually dead. She's in the woods. So he goes and he searches for his wife and his son for years. For 7 years, he goes searching in the woods with no food and no water. God is supporting him. Eventually, he finds the house. He enters. He's like talking to the angel, and this woman comes out, and the son is like, son sees the king, and he's like, oh, who's that? And she goes, oh, it's your father. And the son's like, what? You said God was my father. I don't have a dad. And the king is like, what? You're not my wife. You got hands. And she says, oh, well, I was so good that God let my hands grow back. And he's not quite sure whether to believe them or not. The angel goes and brings out the silver hands that he had made for her. I forgot to mention this, but the king had her, like he had silver hands made for her. So he realizes that this is his wife and this is his child, and they live happily ever after.
God, that's really, that's really spooky and unpleasant.
Yeah, but yeah, so you kind of see like the lessons they're trying to teach these kids. Be pious, listen to your parents, be chaste, be a good wife, have kids.
Yeah.
Protect yourself from the devil by praying to God. Things like that.
Amna, you also have your own kind of visual arts practice.
Yeah.
How do you find that these kind of, I don't know, this kind of aesthetic, does it inform at all the practice?
Definitely, actually. I have a weird fascination with violence and the abject and gore. I guess I'm really interested in like the taboo or things that people like to keep under the covers. I really like also making work, like my goal a lot of the time is to disturb people but also draw them in at the same time, which I guess is like a characteristic I see in fairy tales, where you're getting entertained by this thing when it's also pretty disturbing.
Right.
But yeah, I just like enjoy that tension a lot. I don't know. I think sometimes a lot of things come, I guess, violence is weird. I can see, I know, like, a lot of people have an aversion to it and they don't think it's a good thing to be, like, we definitely have an oversaturation of it in the media. People don't like how violent a lot of, like, video games and things are, and I agree to a point, but I just don't think it makes sense to get rid of it all. I think it definitely has a use, a function, and is worth exploring.
I think there are definitely some images in that story, especially, that are really compelling.
Yeah, like the hands. The stumps. Weeping over her stumps is one of the images that really comes out to me.
Yeah.
Like the purity washing over this
eating pears just without your
with
hands.
With your mouth, yeah. Like and looking like a ghost.
What's the second fairy tale you have for us here?
So the other one I have is the juniper tree, and it has this trope of the evil stepmom who wants too much power.
Cool.
So I guess we can just go right into
it. Yeah, go for it.
So long ago, there was this man who was really rich, and he had a wife. They were really happy, but the woman just wasn't fulfilled because she didn't have a kid. She really, 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 really wanted a kid. So she's praying all the time for a kid. And one day, she goes outside to where they have a juniper tree, and she's trying to get some apples. She's peeling them, and she accidentally cuts herself and bleeds onto the snow, and she goes, oh, if only I had a child as red as blood and as white as snow. And then this magical feeling gets inside of her, and she just goes inside feeling lighthearted. And she just, like, feels like good things are about to happen, but then she falls sick. And so her husband, the rich guy, is taking care of her. And it seems like she's going to die. She has the kid, though. And she's always wanted a kid. She's so joyful that she dies. That's what the story says. She dies of happiness. So the husband buries his wife under the juniper tree and is very sad. But eventually he goes through the grieving process, all the steps and all whatnot, and gets a new wife. So he has this beautiful son who's white as snow and red as blood, and this new wife. And then this new wife has a daughter, and she loves her daughter, but she resents the son because he's the one who's going to inherit the property when her husband dies. And she just is not about this kid standing in the way of her daughter's wealth accruement. So she just, like, this evil takes root inside her and begins to grow, and it makes her act really mean to the treat her son badly. So she, one of the words in the story is she takes him from place to place with cuffings and buffetings. And buffetings is a word for striking someone. So she's like an abusive stepmom to this kid. He lives in fear. He has no time for peace. He just has a horrible life. His whole existence sucks because of his stepmom. So one day her daughter comes home and she says, I want an apple. And her mom's like, sure. Here, come here. There's a chest with the apples. She takes the apple out, and the daughter's like, Mom, can't my brother have an apple too? And the mom's pissed. So she's like, sure, when he comes home from school, he can have an apple. And so she sees the son coming home, and she takes the apple from her daughter. She's, like, taken a hold of by some weird spirit. She takes the apple, and she says, well, you can't have an apple before your brother, kind of, like, inciting the sibling rivalry. And she throws the apple back into the chest and shuts it. And the boy comes in and she says, oh, son, would you like an apple? And he says, Mother, you look awful. Sure, I'll have an apple. And so she takes the kid to her chest. She lifts it open. She goes, here, take one out for yourself. So he bends over the chest and she cuts his head off. She's like, she's planned to murder this kid. So she's like, oh my God, what have I done? She takes him upstairs, puts him in a chair, takes the head out, like rests it on his head and covers the wound with a handkerchief. And the daughter wasn't around for all of this. I don't know what she went to do. It was playing in the yard with the juniper tree or something. But she comes back in and she's like, oh, where's my brother? And she's like, oh, he came home. He's upstairs. Here, take this apple and give it to him. So she goes upstairs and she tries to give him this apple. And she's like, oh, I don't know what's up with him. And then the mom comes upstairs and she like kind of knocks him over and the head rolls off and she's like, what have you done? You killed your brother. She makes her daughter think she killed her brother. And The daughter's really, really, really sad, and she doesn't know what to do. She's a little kid. She just believes what her mom says. So the mom says, okay, well, we have to make him into pudding, obviously. So takes the son and his head, cuts it up real, real small, makes him into pudding. The dad comes home. They're having dinner. He has this dish of black pudding in front of him, and he's like, where's my son? Where's my son? And she goes, oh, he gone. And he goes, no, really, where's my kid? And she says, oh, he went to visit, like, his mom's uncle or something, and he's really sad that his kid didn't say goodbye to him, but he just goes on and he eats his pudding, meanwhile throwing the bones of his dead child under the table. The daughter is so sad. She collects all of the bones. She puts them in a beautiful handkerchief and puts them under the juniper tree. I don't know where this inspiration came from, but, you know. But some magic stuff happens, and the branches start moving, and some mist comes about, and a bird is resurrected from the bones, and it's her brother. She doesn't realize this, but she's brought her brother back to life. And so this bird is really beautiful, and he flies away. He flies to a goldsmith's house, and he sings his song. My mother killed her little son. My father grieved when I was gone. My sister loved me best of all. She laid her handkerchief over me and took my bones that they might lie underneath the juniper tree. Kiwit, kiwit, what a beautiful bird am I. And the goldsmith comes outside. He's making his gold chain, and he's like, yo, bird, sing the song again. And the bird says, I don't play for nothing. Like, you got to give me something. And so he gives him the gold chain. So the bird continues to the shoesmith's house. He sings his song. The shoesmith's like, yo, please play that track for me again. And the bird says, I don't play twice for nothing. And the shoesmith gives him a pair of red shoes. So he flies to the miller's house next. And he sings the song. Of course, the miller's like, play it again. And the bird says, no, you got to give me something. I want that millstone right there, this heavy, large millstone. So he sings the song again. They wrap the millstone around his neck. And he flies back to the house where he's outside at the juniper tree. Meanwhile, this stepmom has this feeling of dread building inside her, while the husband is like, nope, I think I'm going to see your old friend again. Like, I have a good feeling about this day. They see the bird. He's singing his song. They go outside. They think it's so beautiful. The bird gives the dad a gold chain. He gives his sister red shoes, and he drops the millstone on the mom, and she dies, and they live happily ever after.
What is it with these fairy tales being
ultra-violent?
Ultra-violent and also really fake.
So fake? Fake about a bird dropping a millstone on a stepmom?
I mean, how does this bird carry this millstone?
He's a magic bird. He came back to life. He can do anything.
There's a lot of jumps.
He went through death. He can carry a little millstone. He's not any old bird.
I feel like as an audience, we need to make a lot of jumps to believe that stuff.
I suppose so, but think about it. It's kids. It's a fantasy world. You know, fairy tales create this fantasy world. You think if a girl had her hands cut off, she wouldn't bleed to death?
I mean,
how does she get on other stumps? You can't suspend your disbelief for this?
I mean, I can suspend my disbelief. I can. What gets me is when people...
Who knows? Maybe it's like a big bird, like an eagle or something.
But how did these stories stand up with so many plot holes?
Okay.
Like what? This guy just, he's just like, you know...
Well, I guess I wasn't doing the most faithful telling of the story, if you couldn't
no,
tell.
No. I mean, I actually think that it was faithful. I think there's just a lot of gaping plot holes that people are just like, all right, I buy that.
Okay, so what, for instance, do you think is hard to buy?
Well, just like, he's having this pudding, and he asks where, you know,
his son is, and he doesn't realize how big the bones are.
Uncle's house?
Right.
What?
Oh, well, you know.
You're supposed to believe that?
He's supposed to believe that in my culture, like, it's kind of normal for kids to, like, leave and live with their other family members, but the dad is pretty surprised that his son didn't say goodbye to him, and he's really upset about it. But I could see, like, a kid going away to be with other family members. It's just odd that he does so abruptly without the knowledge of his... It's definitely weird, and the dad thinks it's weird, but he kind of lets it go. He's kind of a dunce. Like, have you noticed all the dads in these stories
have, like, a weird... Maybe that's the bigger issue.
They kind of sit back, and they kind of, like... he sells his daughter to the devil without realizing it in the other story. Like,
yeah.
And then he just goes with it.
Yeah,
like,
okay, so maybe that's the thing. Active, maybe it's just these dunce characters.
Maybe. Oh, I think they're all, yeah, I think this is a dumb time.
Is that it? Just like,
maybe that's what it is, yeah. Well, I also like, this is what people feel is important to teach their kids. These are the values they want to teach their kids. Like, this is more important to them than, you know, making their kids into well-rounded people who are independent and like will go out like
but it's interesting that you have these dumb
it's also
dad
like
characters.
Comes out of serfdom, I think, right?
Yeah, true.
Like there's not many places you can go and that like your life isn't going to advance beyond a certain level.
Yeah, yeah.
And many times unless you're gonna be really good so that the king loves you and marries you,
right?
So
right.
I think it comes out of that. There's not much knowledge circulating, not many innovations happening. Like, this is oral history, too.
Yeah, it is.
Or print is a big thing.
It is, yeah,
so.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me that these dunce, you know, father characters, though.
Yeah, it's interesting. You'd think they'd be...
Yeah, you'd think that you would hold up the dad spot. Like, all right, yeah. The dad, you know, keep this patriarchal order in place.
I guess it means you don't have to do much as long as you're a dad.
Right.
And you have the money and you're the... You do your job.
Right.
What you have to do as a girl is, like, be the domestic.
You have to be.
You have to sweep. You have to listen to your parents. You have to pray. You have to...
You have to be on it.
Go with... Yeah. A lot of... What I found interesting about fairy tales is a lot of them revolve around female characters. Like, you don't find many...
True.
Can you think of a story from when you were a kid that was about... Like, there's the heroic boy.
True.
But most of them are about girls who are trying to be princesses,
right,
or something. Like, I just think of Sleeping Beauty and Ariel, who is in trouble because she's disobeying her dad. And then Cinderella. Cinderella's a really messed up story. It's
yeah,
also,
that's
like,
a dark,
the stepmoms
grim one as well, right?
And the stepsisters, yeah, who are so angry. They, like, in one of the versions, they're cutting off their toes to try to fit into the slippers so they can marry the prince. And it's all about, like, the value of beauty, a lot of them. Like, Snow White, the wicked queen, she's so powerful. She has everything in the kingdom. But it's not enough because she's not the most beautiful one in the kingdom.
Right.
And she has to kill Snow White.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot about
image. So it's all about kind of, like, prescribing, I find, what a woman should be.
Beauty standards.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
At least that's the parts that stick out to me, but that's because I'm biased. But
I mean, yeah. I think that they stick out to...
Yeah.
I mean, I just wonder if we're having... I think we've had kind of like a shift in how we understand fairy tales.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think there's some... But then
it's
you look
funny
at Disney
though,
movies...
Like, there's still... Not. All the movies they're putting out are still fairy tales. Like, I think they've had like 3 or 4 versions of Snow White by now in the past 10 years. I took my cousins to see the new Cinderella a couple years ago, and I was pretty disappointed in it because it's still...
It's still
happily ever after. She's still succeeding by just marrying the prince, and it's just like... It's not the worst thing in the world. Like, it's not like they can't grow up to be independent people or anything if they're seeing this stuff. But you do, like, you see the Pixar stuff, and I think it's really great.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take your kid to see your cousins or whatever to see Cinderella. And
yeah.
You're just like, this is kind of awful. They're just, like, idolizing beauty and monogamy.
Right. I hope that there can be some kind of shift.
Oh, yeah.
I hope that in bringing back...
Do you think we even need fairy tales anymore?
I mean, I think we need myths in some
way. Yeah. We need myths.
And I think fairy tales are really just, at the end of the day, but a kind of myth. But, but I mean, I think that bringing back the, like, horror element to the fairy tales is a good way.
Yeah, I always thought the violence of them is really interesting. We, like, see that in our culture where we're kind of... we're repelled by sexuality and we're drawn into violence and we have no problem tolerating it, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you see that in just like the way the Grimm volumes were published. I thought that was really interesting.
Amna, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Have a good afternoon.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth. Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Hilarity. Radical. He's home for improvisational comedy. Theater made up on the spot. Like us on Facebook to learn when our next shows are. Search for us on YouTube for our film sketches. And follow us on Twitter because... You want the bombs. Do you like laughing, hilarity,
cheesy,
radical, thought-provoking creativity, and laughing? UBC Improv is UBC's home for improvisational comedy. Theater made up on the spot. Like us on Facebook to learn when our next shows are. Search for us on YouTube for our film sketches. And follow us on Twitter because we want the followers. UBC Improv. Insert cheesy slogan here.
Hello, this is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. Next up, an interview with Liz, one of our execs here at CITR, talking about her paper for the Tell Me About Your Paper segment. Here it is, CITR 101.9 FM. With Elizabeth Holliday. Elizabeth, how are you?
I am good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. How's your day going?
It's going all right. This is kind of the end of it, so.
Great. Mm-hmm. This is Tell Me About Your Paper, a segment where we talk about research and academic papers and paper writing and the kind of stuff that you get asked at parties when you have to summarize something really quick. So what have you got for us today? What are you bringing?
Well, today I am bringing you my final research paper project from a class I'm doing called GRSJ 422, Directed Research Seminar.
Oh, sweet. Directed Research.
So I'm doing this class with Aisha Chowdhury, who is an incredible and, like, almost intimidatingly academic person. And our focus is on the contemporary race debate in America. So for this paper, we have to look at some aspect of the debate involving critical race theory. It's very open. What I have decided to do is take the track of looking at independent media that is produced along racialized lines. So, for example, I am using a couple art collectives and zines that are specifically require their contributors to be, POC women or whatever it is. And what I'm trying to do is look at how the insistence on, only POC folks can contribute to this zine sort of challenges the discourse of, like, colorblind society where, people don't see color and race isn't an issue and blah, 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 and that just talking about it makes it more of a problem instead of less of a problem, which is what it already is and this sort of thing. So I'm trying to look at how it both, like, combats that discourse, but also hopefully, and I haven't quite figured out how to do this or if I even can do it, but, like, why it is important to have those spaces.
Right, so this is the whole post-racial era.
Lie.
Idea.
Right, yes.
The lie of the post-racial. And the moment you're looking at is, I'm guessing, Black Lives Matter and kind of...
Yeah, because we are looking at America, the debate that we've been focusing on is very much been along, like, black-white lines, obviously not all of the story of race in America at the moment or ever.
Right.
But that is sort of the central focus. So as it's turned out, I have been finding, I think, focusing in on specifically publications or projects that are for, like, spaces for black folks. Yes.
These are like political journals, political zines?
No, they're actually not necessarily. Okay. This is the thing is, what I'm interested in terms of independent media, and this is sort of, like, oriented towards what I would like to do with, like, my life, ideally, so no pressure for this one paper that's supposed to bring everything I'm thinking about together, but they're not necessarily even political. Well, I mean, I guess it's taking, like, a personalist political standpoint, right? Is that, like, it's not necessarily, like, you need to be black people talking about blackness. It's just, like, you are creating art and you are having a space where that is... It is just your art that is going to be there, whether or not that is about the experience, like, your racial experience in that context, or just, like, you being a human being, there's a primacy for, like, your creative output. So, like, I'm looking at a couple, and I have to narrow it down, but I've, like, gotten really excited doing research for it. And I'm looking at the Art Ho Collective, which runs off of Instagram, and cool. is, yeah, for... like exclusively POC folks, but it's a really awesome collective, and people can send things in from all around the world, and entirely internet based, which is very cool. Then there's also one zine that I've been looking at called Shade Zine, and it runs out of LA, I believe. It's also the Thick Thigh Collective, which just started a couple months back, and it's also like the original issue was supposed to be dealing specifically with Black Lives Matter, and so they wanted only Black contributors, and then I think now they've opened it up a little bit more, but the primacy is on queer and POC voices. Yeah, and then one photo project, which is by one man, called The Testament Project, by Chris Graves, which is a photo project about the perceptions of Black people in the media. So it's all kinds of stuff.
Right. And so the topic's not necessarily political, I guess, would make the most sense.
Though I think, like, you know, again, it's just naming that it is important to have that space that is in and of itself a political act, because they're denying like major political forces that are saying that that is not a relevant means of organization or like a relevant area of discussion or way of bringing people together.
What kind of pushback to these kind of mandates or these kind of, I guess, these decisions as, you know, journals and as editors to have, you know, a specific group of people represented and exclusively that. What kind of pushback do they get?
That's actually, thank you, because I've just started making notes on this paper, and that's definitely something I need to do more research on to deal with. I mean, so in these cases, I'm not specifically sure.
It seems to get people up in arms, though.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think as soon as you name race as a factor or an issue, people get freaked out. And one of the main texts that we're using for this class, and I'm also using for this paper, is Eduardo Bonilla Silva's Racism Without Racists, Colorblind Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in America. And a huge part of that deals with, and particularly white people's issue with approaching conversations of race, and also how this discourse of like colorblind nation allows just like structural and institutional and like day-to-day racism to go under the radar, because they're trying to take the racial element away from it and be like, this isn't about race, it's just like how things are, it's just how I feel, it's just the way people are. And yeah, I mean, it's particularly something we've talked about is like, you know, white people have issues talking about race more than racialized people do, because it's something they never have to think about or never want to think about. Yeah.
Right. So there's a whole knowledge issue here too, right? That there is also a certain body of knowledge that you're accessing when you have this kind of contributors working on something.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also, you know, kind of takes or is a combating of the way that racialized bodies are taken up in mainstream media or like, let's say, by like white creatives or whatever it is, and represented in a way that like is not authentic or is, you know, one note is stereotypical, is whatever. Again, I think, and just like the power of people being able to speak for themselves and create for themselves and represent themselves. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your kind of personal relationship with this topic as somebody that makes media, as somebody that works with CITR.
Yeah. I think it's hard because my personal relationship with this topic, I've been thinking a lot about like, again, like how much as like a white woman I can be bringing myself into this. And it's, I don't think it really is my part to, it's not. But one of the thing that I think is so important about independent media, and the thing that especially like my work with CITR has kind of like coaxed me towards this is that it gives people the opportunity to represent themselves in a way that mainstream media doesn't and can't. Yeah, so that's something that I've kind of been toying with or just thinking about a lot, especially looking forward to, like, the end of my degree, which is coming up, and graduate school, if that's going to be a thing, and sort of why it is that I think independent media is important. And one of the big things, I mean, like, you know, this is specifically, I'm looking at, like, racialized organization, but I think it provides a means not only for people to get their own stories out there, just like represent themselves and do whatever it is they do, but also for younger people to get messages about themselves and to be able to recognize themselves in more things, so that the, you know, the amount of input they get on like who it is that they are and who it is that they're supposed to be and like the correct sort of social models they can follow having that open up to not only be like, there are more options for you, but also like, you know, maybe you're going to see, let's say, a show about a character that like you can make a connection to your own experiences, and like that will help kind of pull you forward through that. It's a very sort of vague way of talking about
no,
it.
No, I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think it has to do with non-traditional media forms too, right? We're talking about zines.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about photo collections. I think that that plays a big part in it as well. I mean, it's not CNN. It's not, I don't know, CNN covering like a protest or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that I don't think mass media or, I mean, corporate media, it's a...
Hello, Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. You can hear the rest of that interview with Liz online at CITR's website. And